This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the show we call The Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you.
Show me the money! That's it, brother! But you got to yell that shit! Show me the money! I need to feel you, Jerry! Show me the money! Jerry, you better yell! Show me the money!
Well, that's sort of a raucous way to start a program, but that was a clip from the Jerry Maguire movie, Show Me the Money. Where was the money made in 2017? Because, you know, 2017 has been a year that turned out much more differently than anyone really expected. Almost tailed back into 2016, as a matter of fact. Stocks went up more than anticipated. The Dow is up nominally now 1.9%. S&P up 10.4%. And the NASDAQ up 18.6. The international markets also took off after being stagnant for 4 to 5 years. The international index 17% up. Morgan Stanley International Index up 25%. And it's very clear that investors weren't expecting these gains, because we entered this year with the Federal Reserve just hell-bent on raising interest rates. And prior to the election of Donald Trump, most people were predicting that the markets would tank. Instead, market values in the United States have increased $4 trillion since the election. But it wasn't just the stock market investors alone who made money. Bond investors made money as well, which, well, that wasn't supposed to happen either with the Fed raising interest rates. TLT, which is the Treasury ETF, is up over 6%. LQD, the corporate ETF, up over 5%. And, well, as in the Jerry Maguire movie, people are making money. And I'm not sure if they're all screaming about it like that, but at least they're making it, Jim.
Well, the best thing you can say, John, is the markets have gone up far more than most people expected. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the year, what were we talking about? The Fed just raised interest rates in December, and they said, oh, by the way, instead of 2 times next year, we're going to go 3 times. So a lot of forecasts made at the beginning of the year were expecting 3% interest rates, which means bonds would have lost money. And with the Fed getting aggressive on raising rates, nobody expected stocks to go up as much as they did. But along comes a guy by the name of Donald Trump, promising all kinds of things for the market, from repeal of Obamacare to tax cuts to infrastructure spending to defense spending and deregulation. So the markets have been driven up along a sea of liquidity with the expectation this business recovery will carry on much longer than expected. And of course, along with that would be expanded profits for corporations, which was exactly what we saw in Q1. Corporate profits were up 14%. And it looks like Q2 here is coming in. Corporate profits are looking pretty good at this point. So it has been a good year for investors, especially stock investors, both domestic or international. But there's another story here as well. These gains are mainly concentrated in a few sectors. If we take a look at where have been the highest gains this year, well, definitely it has been technology. We've done a show here recently on the FANG stocks, the Facebook, the Amazons, the Alphabet. In stocks like that, everybody's focused on that. But the NASDAQ 100 is up over 21%. And the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index is up 22%. Well, if you think those gains were good, well, the biotech industry, that's the New York Stock Exchange ARCA Biotech Index, is up over 31%. So it's been a good year for stocks. But like, it almost reminds me, John, of 1999, when the top performing sector was technology. And certainly that's one of the biggest things that we have been talking about in the market is the NASDAQ, which finally exceeded its old highs reached way back in the year 2000. Now the NASDAQ is over 6,000. It's almost 6,400. And some are calling that the NASDAQ may even hit 7,000.
Well, okay, I know we're talking about technology, Jim, here, but there are about 9 or 10 sectors within the S&P, so is it just technology?
No, there's probably about four or five, and this is one of the things that you've heard our technicians on the show mention, the broad-based rally. In other words, it's not just one sector in particular, although the FANG stocks and technology certainly stand out. But if we look at the nine sectors within the S&P, technology is certainly at the top with a return of 19.6. Healthcare, which you would expect given all the political rhetoric coming out of the White House. Healthcare stocks are up about 18.4. Consumer discretionary, and this is one that sort of puzzled a lot of people, thought with a weak retail Christmas season in the fourth quarter, consumer discretionary stocks are up about 12.5%. Material stocks are up 12. Industrial stocks up a little over 11. And the one that surprises people are utility stocks, which are up almost 11% as well. Usually, if you are heading towards a peak in the economy or a peak or moving more towards the risk-off trade, you would expect to see healthcare stocks, consumer staples, and utility stocks do well. Well, staples have not done as well, and healthcare has done well, but utility stocks are right up there as well with double-digit returns, actually exceeding the S&P 500. And a lot of that, John, is a result of people searching for yield as interest rates have come down when people were anticipating that rates were going to go up. So you have five sectors that would go along with what, let's say, President Trump was proposing. What did he talk about? He talked about cutting taxes. He talked about bringing jobs back here with factories. He talked about revitalizing our industrial sector and also infrastructure spending. So what would go along with that? Materials would certainly go along with a rebuilding of infrastructure. Industrial stocks would do well. And certainly healthcare stocks would be doing well with the repeal of Obamacare, although it looks like so far the Republicans have not been able to pull that off. So you have five sectors that are really the clear performers. And really, as you take a look at the S&P 500 itself, there's really only been one sector that is on the negative side for the year that hasn't done well. It was the sector that did the best last year, which was the energy sector, which really took off in the fourth quarter with anticipation of OPEC production cuts. So if you take a look at what has done well, industrials, healthcare, materials, and technology, which would go along with what the Trump presidency has been proposing so far, the only thing that's been done has been done on the regulatory front with executive orders.
Okay, so utilities are doing well, but with interest rates between 1% and 2%, investors are searching for yield, and where the heck are you going to get it?
Well, yeah, believe it or not, if you take a look at the stock market still offers the highest yield in comparison to the bond market because treasuries have been stuck in a narrow trading range, as most of our technicians have talked about all year. But it just wasn't the stock and bond market. The one thing about this market is some other asset classes have done as well. In the commodity space, the ag sector, especially the grains, wheat prices have been on fire, but it isn't all clear for the commodity space. Oil is down. It's negative for the year. It's lost money. Actually, oil prices are down about 12%, and the XLE, the energy index, is down double digits as well. Gold and silver are up. They're doing okay, but they're not doing spectacular, which has surprised a lot of individuals, especially with the dollar coming down. You would expect gold to have been a stronger performer. So far, it's positive, and gold stocks are positive, but not by much. The indexes are only up in the low single digits, so in the commodity space, it has not gone as well. Clearly, the winner this year across all fronts has been the stock market. I don't care if you're looking at domestic stocks here in the U.S., or you're looking at some of the international indexes, stocks across the globe seems to be the preference where the money has been so far. If you're looking at where has the money been made, well, clearly it's been in the stock market.
It's interesting, you know, because everybody thought that last year's winner, which was energy, would have carried over into this year, especially with the OPEC cuts. Energy stocks were okay in the first quarter, above $50 a barrel, but the second quarter didn't do that. So what happened?
Well, I mean, there were two things. I mean, everybody expected with higher prices that shale production would increase in the U.S. I think it surprised a lot of people how quickly that production increased year over year. Production is up a little over close to 1 million barrels. The rig count has nearly doubled since its low of last year. But two other factors also contributed. Two areas or two countries that were exempt from the cutbacks from OPEC were Nigeria and Libya. They were having political issues there, and they still are. But increased production from Libya and from Nigeria, that's about 700,000 barrels. And if you take a look at 1 million barrels of production increases coming from the U.S., ate into most of the production cuts of 1.8 million coming from OPEC. Now, the good news is inventories continue to fall in the U.S. I think this is the 12th consecutive week, or there's 11 out of 12 consecutive weeks that we've seen fall in inventories, and we're also seeing gasoline levels fall. But of course, you would expect to see that because we are now in the midst of the summer driving season. People are in their cars. They're taking vacation. But something else is also happening that may help reduce these inventories, because U.S. inventory levels seems to be the thing that everybody is focusing on. The Saudis are now reducing shipments to the U.S. Last week, shipments of oil to the U.S. fell to 524,000 barrels a day. That's probably the lowest that we've seen in 7 years. And just to show you how dramatic it's been, that is down from 851,000 barrels a day, and that's the lowest we've seen since the year 2010. So Saudi oil shipments have dropped by 300,000 barrels.
You know, if you listen to the cable channels or some of the news stations, they're really making it sound like shale oil is carrying us to energy independence. But we're still currently importing here 8 to 9 million barrels a day. So the talk about energy independence just isn't going to happen at that rate out of shale.
Well, no. And like you just mentioned, we're still importing about 8.5 to 9 million barrels. Now, granted, it's down from the 10, 11, 12 million barrels that we were importing back in 2005 when oil was rising from $50 a barrel ultimately to $150. But what is drawing down the inventories has not been just the OPEC cuts, but also, don't forget, John, oil demand globally is still growing, and especially in China, oil is growing according to the IEA estimates for this year. Oil consumption is supposed to grow about 1.3 million barrels a day. In the next 2 years, oil consumption globally is supposed to hit the 100 million barrel mark. But here's the issue. As is typical of late business cycle expansions, John, we're just not seeing the late inflation trades or the heating up of inflation that you'd normally see in a rate raising cycle coming from the Fed. If you look at previously, they would talk about an economy overheating. Think about 2005, real estate prices going bonkers, going up double digits a year. Oil prices were going from 50 to 150. And so the result was we were seeing increasing levels of inflation moving towards 5%, which caused the Fed to keep raising interest rates a quarter of a point at every FOMC meeting. This year, that has not happened. We have not seen an overheated economy. We're certainly nowhere near 3, 4, or 5% in GDP growth, and we're certainly not seeing inflation. In fact, in the last couple of months, inflation levels are dropping again. I think a lot of that has to do directly related to the price of energy. So I think one of the main reasons the Fed has felt okay to start normalizing interest rates has been the one sector where money seems to be flowing. If you want to say, show me the money, it's showing up in the financial markets, mainly in the stock market, as reflected in the gains that we just talked about so far in 2017.
So this comes back to our question, why are central banks talking about raising rates when inflation expectations are falling short? There doesn't seem to be any reason for doing this.
Well, I think they know at some point in time they're going to need to have bullets in the chamber. They're going to have something to fight the next recession or the next financial crisis, because contrary to what Janet Yellen said, which she sort of later threw in a few caveats when she said we're unlikely to see another financial crisis in her lifetime, she later backtracked and she said, look, we can't predict black swans that could occur and most likely overseas. And that is likely to happen. Remember, the European Central Bank taking a lesson from the Fed, is trying to queue up the markets in Europe, that they're going to stop QE as well. And we've certainly seen German interest rates double in the last couple of weeks. So they're hoping to avoid the taper tantrum we saw here in 2013. But nonetheless, I think the reason they're doing it is they want to normalize interest rates. And if they keep interest rates at zero, we are going to have a bubble somewhere, because it creates an incentive to speculate. If you can borrow at a low interest rate, for example, if you could have borrowed before the Fed started raising interest rates, when the Fed funds rate was at 0.25, let's suppose that you could borrow interest rates at a rate of interest of 0.25%. All you'd have to do is go into an S&P 500 fund, and the dividend yield on the S&P was 2.25%. So you'd make almost 8 times the money that it would cost you to borrow. And that's the risk that central banks have in keeping interest rates artificially low, is it encourages leverage and speculation, which is why we saw the crisis that we did between 2007 and 2009.
Well, we know technology stocks, healthcare, industrials were the big winners in the beginning of the year, but now we're in the third quarter, and what will make money for the rest of the year?
Well, we're still in the risk-on phase in the market. If you take a look at what stocks are doing right now, technology continues to lead, along with healthcare, consumer discretionary, industrials. And there's no weakening in the trends in those particular sectors. All are in strong uptrends at this point. And we're starting, some of the technicians are saying that energy is probably close to a bottom at this point. And despite a falling dollar, there's a possibility that gold or silver could start a liftoff. I mean, gold and silver are both up slightly, low single digits for the year. But one trend that we're starting to see is that the dollar has fallen. Now, a lot of people, at least from our perspective, we think the dollar is oversold, and you might see a short-term bounce here, which would be weakness for the gold market, which could be an opportunity. But so far, right now, is the trends that have been in place, and technicians will tell you this on the program, a trend in place remains a trend until it's disrupted. And there's no sign of any of these trends, whether it's technology, healthcare, industrial, or consumer discretionary, there's no sign of any of those trends being reversed. So as we've seen so far, there is no sign of a reversal at this point. The five main sectors, technology, healthcare, discretionary, materials, and industrials, continue to drive this market into new higher levels. The question that we will have to look at, especially as we head into the fall, where you tend to get into those weak months of the year, usually September and October, if you're going to have any kind of storms in the market, they tend to show up right around that period. What was interesting, if you go back to the first hour of the program, as Gary Dorr said, this has been the first year you haven't seen anything even approaching as much as a 5% correction in the market. So far, we've only had a correction of about 2.8%. That mainly occurred in the FANG and technology stocks. But so far, we haven't even approached 5%. So as we head into the fall, everybody's going to look for, will these trends remain in place, or will we see what is anticipated will become the inflation trade, which would be a pickup in oil prices, which would lead to higher inflation levels. And also, if any continued weakness in the dollar, should it continue after this recent short-term rally that we see here, would we see a pickup in the price of precious metals? John Hathaway recently wrote a piece in Barron's, and he said, look, this stuff can continue, but we always know in the end, we always have corrections, we always have bear markets, and we always have recessions. And he said gold has always been a safe haven. So will that happen? Well, we'll have to watch. But right now, even though the markets are driven by and dominated by the FANG stocks that we talked about, which are also being driven by passive index funds, this year will be a record. It's expected that increases or money flowing into these index funds will be up by 60% this year, expected to reach over $800 billion, which could drive these markets up even further. So that raises the question, what will happen in Q3 and Q4? I would expect, John, we're probably going to see some form of rotation and the possibility that we may see the reflation trade.
Well, if we take out some of the indexing in the FANG stocks, if you back things like that out, would we say that it's doing as well?
There's been a couple studies that have been done. We've done our own. If you back those stocks up, the markets are still up roughly about 7%. So, you know, still a decent year for the market. The other thing that we also look at is the advanced decline line. Several of our technicians refer to it, and it measures the number of stocks that are going up. And so far, that has been another indicator of indicating a market peak. Because if you go back to the bear market of 2000 and 2007, even though the indexes were hitting a new record at the beginning of 2000 and all throughout much of 2007, it wasn't until you got to the fall of 2007 that the markets peaked. But there was a divergence. The advanced decline line was beginning to fall, so it wasn't supporting in a narrow range of stocks. We're commandeering the most of the support for the indexes hitting new records. And so some people have said, well, gee, if you know, it's these FANG stocks that are driving the markets up. Not necessarily, because if you take a look at the S&P above its 200-day average, it's still up above it. And 72% of the stocks within the S&P are up above their 200-day averages. So there's no sign or any divergence of the advanced decline line or the S&P showing signs of divergence where you just have this small concentration of stocks. Yes, we're seeing it in the FANG stocks, but we're also seeing it in the other indexes. If you take the S&P 500, there's 9 sectors. There's only one sector that has done horribly this year, and that's been the energy sector.
So right now, most of our technicians, and I think Ryan mentioned this during his segment, no signs of negative divergence. So the question is, number one, what keeps this thing going? And number two, what are the prospects that it's going to continue for some time?
Well, what do we have going for us? We're seeing it in Q2 earnings so far. We have strong corporate earnings. The economy is still chugging along at 2%, albeit it's not growing. It's anticipated. And here's the big if, John, on all of this. Will the Republicans get tax cuts? Because if there is a stimulus, if they want to have an impact on the economy and the markets, the biggest thing they could do is tax cuts. If you cut corporate tax rates, that increases corporate profits. If you cut tax rates on corporations and individuals, it puts money in pockets. So that money will get spent. The economic expansion continues. Corporate earnings increase. The stock market will continue to go up. As far as infrastructure spending, as we've seen not only under President Obama and even likely under President Donald Trump, even if they were to pass an infrastructure spending bill, it might be 2 to 3 years before it actually would get implemented and the money would actually get spent in the economy. So right now, the one best thing that we have is monetary policy, believe it or not, is still accommodative. I mean, the Fed funds rate is at 1.25%. And believe it or not, in 2004, when Greenspan began to reverse policy and raise rates, he began with the Fed funds rate at 1%. We're still only at 1.25%. And Janet Yellen recently came out and she said, you know what, going forward, you know, we're unlikely to get to a 3% Fed funds rate. So even the Fed has backed off on what it once thought it would likely get to when they first thought about raising interest rates. They were talking about getting back to a normal rate of 4 or 5%. Yellen has recently indicated, you know, I don't think we're going to get to 3%. So what do we have right now? We have the third longest expansion in U.S. history. And right now, economists give a probability of a recession of only 24%. So the one thing that can maybe extend this well into 2019, maybe even as far as 2020, would be the possibility of tax cuts. And of course, if that was coupled with infrastructure, would take this economic recovery well beyond 2019, because tax cuts would, let's say, have an impact immediately. And if they coupled that with infrastructure, then all of a sudden the infrastructure spending would kick in. The only thing that would nullify that, if the Fed made the dramatic mistake and say, oh, the tax cuts are stimulating the economy, the infrastructure spending is in stimulating the economy, all of a sudden the Fed gets very aggressive. And the reason I bring this up, it was a lesson that Bernanke talked about when he did his doctoral thesis on the Great Depression. This is exactly what happened in 1937. The Roosevelt administration was spending a lot of money, deficit spending. The economy was zooming along at high single-digit interest rates. rates. The stock market was up over 3%. Budget deficits were growing. And the Fed came in 1937 and said, we got to put a stop to this. We've got inflation heating up. They just ratcheted up interest rates and threw the economy back into a depression. Would they make the same mistake again? You never know. Right now, there are some that are even critical of the Fed, saying that they're now, even though they may not be raising interest rates in the month of July, and they may even wait to raise rates till the end of the year in December, they're talking about shrinking their balance sheet, which is another form of tightening. Could the Fed be making the same mistake? But right now, what we see the dollar topping. And right now, the dollar is short-term oversold. If we do see that top usher in inflation, then what we would be looking for is the inflation trade. And what we are looking for is a market rotation from the current trends that have been in place all year. We're monitoring and taking a look at, for that inflation trade, which would be good for oil. It would also be good for gold. You would see a revaluation. So it could change everything. And so we're watching the dollar. We're watching the credit markets and signs of stress, because that's where it'll show up first. And of course, the LEIs, the leading economic indicators, some of them are somewhat mixed, but still point to positive economic growth going forward. But what we're looking for here in the third quarter is that rotation, which we think is going to take place.
So as we began this segment, which we entitled Show Me the Money, the gains are being made in the technology area, healthcare, consumer discretionary, industrials, and materials. And it would seem to be filling out the promises made during the Trump candidacy and the earlier period of last year.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
This is so frustrating. I wish I had a crystal ball to tell me how to invest.
That's old school. You just need to ask CeCe.
CeCe? Who's CeCe?
Well, let me tell you. It's a personal assistant search app that works through your smartphone.
Really? How does it work?
Here, look. Just ask CeCe a question. Go ahead. Try it.
Sure. Okay. CeCe, what stock should I buy?
Searching. My results say chicken stock gets the best reviews.
No, not chicken stock.
Be more specific, Dad.
Okay, show me stock bargains.
Searching. National Western Stock Show January 2018 bargains on prize Angus beef.
CeCe, not stock shows.
Betting 100, Dad?
I want to know what stocks, CeCe, are good to buy in the stock market.
Searching. Stock advice: buy low, sell high.
Well, everybody knows that.
Thank you for the compliment.
And this is good advice, son.
It works for everybody else.
CeCe, seriously, I want to know what bargains can be had in the stock market, in the Dow.
Searching. The Dales, Oregon Big Street Fair this weekend. Great bargains.
Okay, son. Had it. Just kill it.
All right, I'll kill it.
Domestic violence detected. Dialing 911 now. Police are on the way.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Mainstream companies within these industries are latching onto these ideas, the idea of craft and local and sustainable and handmade and organic. These have become really, really valuable marketing terms that businesses are using. And in many cases, we're seeing larger corporations simply buy these businesses up and have them on their roster. I think a big part of it also has to do with what the future is for millennials. This is a huge millennial trend that had emerged as millennials were coming of age.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Before we proceed with the big picture, the second part of it today, I wanted to mention to everybody that, Jim, you have your Investment Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference coming up on October 21st, and I think you need to talk to people about that because it's something worthwhile.
Yeah, it's going to be an all-day event. We usually put this on once a year. This year is going to be just jammed with information. We're going to talk about the final end game, how this market is unfolding, and what we think is coming up ahead. It's going to be one of strategy and tactics. We'll also get into wealth preservation ideas, not just preserving your investment portfolio, but preserving wealth for things that are coming on. In fact, it's a topic that if you have a chance, listen to Monday's show on lifetime income, because our Congress critters are talking about doing away with a strategy that is going to cause higher taxation on IRAs for beneficiaries. And so it's a wealth preservation strategy. Not only are we going to talk about the end game in the financial markets and preparing for that, how you should be positioning yourself, but also preserving wealth as well when it comes to your assets. All that is going to be coming up on the 21st. It's an all-day event. It is free to clients, but there is a cost of $100, which includes the materials handed out as well as breakfast and lunch that will be served. But it's an all-day event. It's coming up. Make your reservations, especially if you're back in that cold country looking for a way to get out into the sunshine. It'll be October 21st.
And where can they get more information, Jim?
You can go to our website, financialsense.com, and right there at the top is a green banner for our Investment Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference. It's right at the top of our webpage. All the information you need is detailed right there.
You know, this economic recovery has been well below the norms of last recoveries, if we look back over the last 70 years. Typical economic growth coming out of any kind of a downturn has been around an average of 3-4%. This economic recovery did no better than 2%, which is obviously you can see is far below normal. This has puzzled the Fed, and it should be noted the Fed's forecasts have been way off the mark. And actually, the slow recovery delayed the Fed's tightening process. It took them 4 years to raise interest rates 5 times. Now, it's also puzzled Wall Street as well as Washington, with both parties in Washington laying the blame for the sort of slow recovery on the policies of the opposition party. Here's a simple fact. This is the third longest U.S. recovery, not just since World War II, but as far back as 1854. That's one of those wow things, Jim.
Yeah, we've been talking about World War II, but when you really think about it, John, this goes all the way back to 1854. So I guess in one way you can say, well, the economic growth rate has not been that high. You know, certainly a 2% economic growth rate isn't as much as the 3, 4, and 5% growth rates that we typically had coming out of a recession. That being said, we also know that every recession and bear market since World War II has been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle, John, which is where we are now.
Okay, so if the cycle is late in the tooth and the Fed's already raising interest rates, how do you predict the next recession and downturn in the markets then?
You know, in the past, if you take a look and talk to somebody about, you know, what have been the reliable predictors of recessions? And in the past, one of the favorite indicators has been the yield curve. For those of you not familiar with it, it is the difference between short-term and long-term interest rates. Like, for example, the interest rate on a 2-year treasury note versus, let's say, the interest rate on a 10-year treasury note. So when people look at the yield curve, whenever it gets inverted, which means that short-term interest rates rise faster and are at a higher interest rate than long-term interest rates, that's called a yield curve inversion. And whenever we see that, it has been a good predictor of recessions. If you look at the recession of 1991, the recession of 2001, or the recession of 2007, prior to those recessions, the yield curve inverted in every single one of them.
Okay, when we see that, Jim, what makes that such a good predictor?
Well, one reason is the impact of credit. Now, think of you're a bank. Credit contracts as profit incentives are removed from the banks to lend. Because what does a bank do? A bank borrows money short term. So if you have money on deposit with the bank, you have a 3-month CD, a 6-month CD. This is where bank funding comes from. It comes from short term money. And the reason is the spread in terms of what the bank is going to pay you on that short term deposit and what they're going to charge you on the opposite end. If you walk into a car dealership and borrow money for 5 years on a car loan, or go out and buy a house and borrow money on a 30-year mortgage. So banks make the difference between short term interest rates and long term interest rates. Now think of it this way. What happens if the yield on short term interest rates is higher than the yield on long-term interest rates? If you were a bank, why in the heck would you pay your depositors more money in interest in terms of what you could get if you were to loan money out on a car loan or on a mortgage loan? So what happens is the yield curve inverts. What happens, you tend to see credit contract, banks stop making loans, the economy slows down, and we go into a recession. So when the yield curve inverts, short-term rates are actually higher than long-term rates. That removes the incentive to lend money. So credit contraction happens in the economy, and eventually that leads to a recession. So far, we have seen the yield curve is foretold every recession since 1950, with one exception in 1994. In 1994, the Fed funds rate was doubled. Greenspan doubled the rate from 3% to 6%. Imagine if the Fed was to do that today in a single year. That was the year of the infamous peso crisis. It was the year that Orange County filed for bankruptcy. It was very disruptive. But we never got into a recession, even though the yield curve inverted. Right now, the yield curve has been flattening, so short-term rates are rising, and they're closer to long-term rates.
I guess another anomaly we'd throw in here, which is really an issue, would be that this long-term recovery really hasn't followed the normal path for recoveries, nor the interest patterns, you know, with the Fed's rate-raising cycles.
Well, this was a concern, John. You know, people were looking at this last year as we got closer towards the election. Some people said that the slowing in the economy might have had one effect on the outcome of the election. The yield curve was starting to flatten as we were leading up into the election last year. And if you look at the stock market returns last year were not that great. Leading up to the November elections, the market was only up 3 or 4%. So nothing stellar as it ended in the final 6 weeks of the year following the election. So it was something that people pay attention to. But instead of contracting, what happened is after the election, the market took off. Confidence among consumers and business, especially small business, skyrocketed. The LEIs began to pick up, and once again, the yield curve steepened with the Fed raising interest rates in December and then also changing their language for 2017 and saying, hey, we're not going to raise rates twice. We're going to go 3 times. So one of the things that we're watching right now is the yield curve once again has begun to flatten. The difference between the 2-year treasury note and the 10-year treasury note is less than 0.9%. And so that is something that a lot of economists and some of the people in the bearish camp are starting to look at. And it's certainly one of the indicators we look at in our recession model, which is a little bit more complex.
But Jim, you know, some bond experts like Bill Gross actually think the indicator's broken because of all the Federal Reserve intervention.
That certainly, I mean, if you take a look at globally, central banks have poured roughly with quantitative easing. If you take our Fed, we see our Fed's balance sheet is $4.6 trillion. I think the ECB is up to $4.8 trillion globally with the Bank of Japan and other central banks. They've poured $15 trillion into the global economy with QE. And that has led, as we have talked so many times, that it has led to the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. In something I hope to do during our August recess, I don't want to announce it yet, but I am hoping that I'm going to get to interview one of the experts on interest rates, the Bible on interest rates, because certainly one of the questions I want to ask as I reread his book is that if you take recorded human history, 5,000 years, the last 40 years, we have really seen something that is so unusual in recorded human history. We've seen the highest interest rates since 3000 BC in 1981. And last summer, we saw the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. So if you take the last 40 years in the financial markets, we have truly experienced one of the most unusual periods of interest rates in any time in human history. Even as we stand today, even though we've seen interest rates start to rise here in the U.S. and elsewhere, there is still $5 trillion of investment-grade bonds that actually still carry a negative interest rate. And most of the damage, as we saw in the financial crisis in 2007, occurs on the short end. If you are a company that has your bonds junk bond rated, you have short-term debt, or you may have adjustable rate debt. As the Fed raises interest rates, what does that do? It raises your cost of borrowing and your interest rates. As the yield curve flattens and banks refuse to roll over credit or not make loans, what happens is a lot of these loans end up in default. And so most of the damage in the crisis always occurs in the short end of the yield curve, where rates are rising and repriced. And that is one of the things, John, we are doing for our clients right now, is we are in the adjustable bond market, because as the Fed raises interest rates, which I think they'll do again in December, every time the Fed raises interest rates, just like adjustable rate mortgage, our adjustable rate bonds that we own in our client portfolios, they get adjusted upward, and we're earning 4 to 5%. Now, that's probably not as exciting as owning a tech stock, but, you know, 4 or 5% for somebody that's a conservative investor is a good rate of return, and it also protects us in a rising interest rate environment as we are now. But the process of QE is, and I agree with Bill Gross, it is suppressing long-term interest rates. In other words, if we take a look at 10-year treasuries, which are closer to 2.4%, we would probably be looking at higher interest rates if it wasn't for QE, because the European Central Bank is still in the marketplace buying bonds, I think $60 billion a month. That's keeping interest rates suppressed. The difference between interest rates here and the interest rates overseas is causing money to flow into the treasury markets in the United States, which is keeping a lid on interest rates here longer term, which is one reason why you've seen a flattening in the curve. So a lot of the experts say this is one reason why the yield curve is not as effective. I would still argue that it is still a good predictor if combined with other indicators to predict recessions.
Okay, well, what happens is that a yield curve inversion is when the short-term interest rates rise above the long-term rates. And what that does is that removes the incentive for banks to make loans. And so credit as a result of that contracts. And then we find that we're in a recession. Now, given that the Fed is raising interest rates, is this a good indicator of which direction we're headed?
I still do. I still believe it is, because one reason why we have not seen the financial stocks have performed poorly this year is because the yield curve has sort of been flattening. And banks obviously are incentivized to make more loans when the yield curve is steepening, meaning long-term rates are much, much higher than short-term rates. When the yield curve flattens, as it is doing now, and the spread between the 2-year and the 10-year is less than, let's say, 0.9%, the incentive to make lending is reduced. But, you know, like anything else, we use multiple indicators to take a look at our recession indicator, which incorporates the yield curve. That's only one. And currently, our recession indicator is at 9.5%. When we get worried is whenever it rises up to 20. Now, just after the election, it was down to 5. It's recently gone up to 9.5. We get concerned when it rises to 20. And the last time that we saw it rise to 20 was in the second quarter 2011. And if you remember what was going on in 2011, we had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. We had a spike in oil prices, hard to believe, at $110 a barrel. We had the pig crisis in Europe, where Greek bond yields got to be 30%. Italian bond yields got to be 8% and 9%. Currently, they're around 2%. And we also had the U.S. had its debt downgrading from AAA to AA. So it was currently looking like we were heading towards a recession. Of course, then the Fed used an extension. It got more aggressive in quantitative easing. We went to what we call quantitative easing in perpetuity because they gave us no timeline or no set amount as they did previously. But currently, our recession indicator is risen. It's up at 9.5, but it's certainly nowhere near a danger territory. If you want to know what our thinking is, my son Chris wrote an article on our website. It's called The End Game that gets into a lot of the things that we're talking about here and others that we don't have the time to cover in today's program. But all of this leads us to think in the same way that Ray Dalio talks about, we're watching the tea leaves and we're watching those tea leaves more closely than ever before.
Well, speaking of tea leaves, I know you can't be specific about some of this stuff, but what are the things you're monitoring?
Well, I mean, some of the things that we are monitoring is the yield curve that has flattened recently. We are also watching credit spreads. So far, they have narrowed. If there's going to be trouble, it will show up in credit spreads first, and that will lead well before the stock market. We are watching the money supply, and we are watching stock market valuations. Those are just a number of things we're looking at. But right now, one of the things that we have seen as a result of Fed tightening, bank credit growth has fallen remarkably from a peak of a year-over-year growth rate of 8.3%. It is now just up 3.3% recently. Secondly, we're starting to see delinquency rates are starting to rise again with possible peak in corporate profits. Third, and here's the other thing, that even if the yield curve was to steepen, the U.S. corporate sector is leveraged and is unlikely to leverage much further. In other words, corporate balance sheets over the last 4 or 5 years, corporations have been taking out refinancing, using debt instead of equity to raise dividends, to buy back stock. So it's unlikely, John, that we're going to see corporations leverage more so than where they are right now. And as the Fed continues to tighten, especially as the Fed contracts its balance sheet and also raises interest rates, I would suspect that tightening will weigh on money supply growth and we'll see further weakening. But we're also monitoring the LEIs, but we have what I call advanced indicators of the leading economic indicators that we watch. Yield curve, credit spreads, money supply are just a number of things that we're monitoring. So as Ray Dalio or his predecessor might have said, Chuck Prince, we're still dancing, but once again, we're closer to the exit door. But those are the things that we think are valid indicators of predicting when, if the next recession occurs. And like I said, one of the big ifs out there that would change this equation and postpone it for a lot longer would be if the Republicans could implement tax reform, lowering corporate tax rates from 35% down to 20 or 15 and lower income tax rates for individuals. That would put money in the pocket of individuals immediately and would extend this out much further than what we're saying now.
Well, coming up next week, Jim, we have the Fed's Open Market Committee. That meeting's supposed to happen between the 25th and the 26th next week, so that's scheduled. Anything else that we're going to be watching?
You know, two other things on the horizon. We're still working our way through corporate earnings season, so we're looking for what's going to transpire in the third quarter. We're watching oil, because in the fourth quarter, we're looking for that rotation, the reflation trade. And then the other thing is we have the Jackson Hole meeting when the conclave of central bankers and who's who on Wall Street will be getting together. Is there anything that's going to come out at Jackson Hole that Yellen might say, you know what, next month we start contracting our balance sheet. So those are the big events that are coming up, and that leads us into what I call, a sailor once told me, the grand banks are no picnic in the fall. Well, the markets typically tend to be not a picnic in the fall. If we have any market weakness or there's any serious corrections, they tend to occur around September, October. Remember, so far in 2017, we haven't even experienced as much as a 5% correction. So those are the things we'll be watching, and hope you'll be there with us. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.